We are in the middle of Matthew 24. We left on a bit of a cliffhanger last class period. But just kind of refresh your minds. We entered chapter 23, which is the fifth major discourse in the Gospel of Matthew. The fifth major discourse, which makes up Matthew's own somewhat of a Pentateuch. Yes? No, we do have a test this week, but the test is on Friday. Test is on Friday. Okay? All right, we'll talk about more of the test tomorrow, but just all you need to know is tests on Friday. Okay, so Matthew 23, we enter the fifth major discourse, and Matthew 23 is littered with seven woes to the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, the Jewish elite, where Jesus basically just lays it out for him and, takes off the kiddie gloves and starts fighting the way that we're not used to seeing him fighting. At the end of chapter 23, he predicts the destruction of the temple for the first time when he says, "Look, your house is left to you desolate," which is the same conversation that begins at the beginning of chapter 24, where Jesus comes, all the disciples are like, "Hey, look at how beautiful this is," which without the Dome of the Rock, because that wouldn't have been in existence. But look at all these amazing, buildings and these amazing walls and things like that. And Jesus says, "I tell you the truth, that not one of these stones will be standing on one of another whenever I come back and destroy it all," in a sense. They asked him the question, "Well, when will that event happen? That is," they say, "the end of everything. Because surely the only way this is going to be destroyed is if everything is destroyed." And then Jesus, in the first 35 verses of Matthew 24, launches into a discussion of what? The destruction of the temple. And what is the key characteristics about the destruction of the temple in the first 35 verses of Matthew 24? What is he constantly saying? Two things in particular. That it is different from the second coming. Exactly. And what makes it different? Two things that make it different.
That you'll know the end, you'll know when it happens.
Yes. Exactly, that there are clear signs of the destruction of the temple, right? For the destruction of the temple, there are clear signs. But for the second coming, there are not clear signs. And we'll get to that more today. What is the second thing that he also says is very different between the destruction of the temple and the second coming? When it happens. Exactly. Because in the first 35 verses, he's constantly using the word "you," "you," "you." And who is that referring to? The disciples. Because that's who he's talking to. "You," he says. And he also uses language like "this generation." But what we're going to find in chapter 24 and 25, we've already dealt with it some in the first six verses, is that the second coming, there is no signs, and it's a long ways away. There is a significant delay between the two time periods. Okay. At the end of last class period, we dealt with Matthew 24:36. Why do I think that there is a shift in topic at verse 36 of Matthew 24? Very important. You won't find it in the NIV. Hopefully you wrote it there. But concerning. Periday in the Greek, but concerning. And if you trace this throughout like 1 Corinthians and other Pauline letters, you will see this is a very distinct, very emphatic Greek construction that indicates a shift in topic. But concerning this. But concerning this. He's shifting topics. And he moves into the discussion of the second coming. Okay. We dealt with the rapture at the very end of last class period. And basically what I said was what? There is no rapture. As a matter of fact, we looked at the verse in context of verse 36 through 41. And what do we notice whenever he's talking about at the times of Noah? Who is swept away? In context, it's the evil that's taken away, not the good. So even one of the key verses for rapture, they get it completely backwards. Because it says, at the times of Noah, and he says it'll be the same thing at the second coming. And he goes on and he says, I'm going to recap this so that people that weren't there or people that were sleeping because they stayed up all night doing their term paper, right? We can make sure we're all on the same page. As it was in the days of Noah, so it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. For in the days, verse 38, for in the days before the flood, People were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, up to the day Noah entered the ark. Who is on the outside of the ark? The evil. And they knew nothing about what would happen until the flood came and took them all away. Who did the flood take away? The evil. The evil. And then he says, right after that, he says, that is how it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. Two men will be in the field, one will be taken, the other left. Two women will be grinding with a handmill, one will be taken, the other left. Who is taken? The evil. Who is left? The good. Why? Because we're still going to use this place. That was something I had a really cool conversation with my kids on our way home from church this past Sunday. We were talking about heaven, about the way heaven was going to be. And my son asked a very astute question. He said, now, when we go to heaven after Jesus comes back, because we talked to him about my kids, their eschatology is going to be very solid by the time they come of age. But he understands that heaven is different when Jesus comes back. And he says, when Jesus comes back, will we be here or will we be in heaven? And I got to tell him, I said, well, Revelation 21 says that heaven and earth combine. They're one and the same. There'll be a new heaven and a new earth because of a couple things. Number one, fire will purify the earth. But it doesn't mean it's going to destroy the earth in the sense that it's going to be completely scrapped and started over. As a matter of fact, the word for new that is used is the word kainos in Greek, which means redeemed or restored. Not created ex nihilo. I mean, that's not what it means. And so my son was like, so you mean we're going to be able to be on the earth? I said, yeah, but picture the earth without any decay, without any corruption, and with Jesus walking with you the whole time. I said, that's going to be heaven. And then I told him this. I said, and guess what? We also get new resurrected bodies. And he was like, what? And next thing you know, he was like, so will I be able to shoot out spider webs like Spider-Man? I said, I don't know. You might be able to make requests at the door. I'm not sure how it works. But I did tell him this. I said, but what I do know, is that Jesus was able to move through walls in his resurrected body. Because whenever he appears at his resurrection, the doors are locked and everyone's in the room and all of a sudden he appears. So we're going to be able to do some cool stuff. Bottom line is this. Why are we left? Why do I want to be left behind? Because this is where heaven's going to be coming down and combining. We're going to use this place. It's just going to be purified. So, I want to be left behind. Why? Because the text tells me the good are left behind, not the evil. Reflections, thoughts on that. I know that can be earth-shattering for a lot of people, and I don't want to be insensitive to that, so I want to give you 5 minutes or so to dialogue with me about that, if you're very concerned about that. Because I know right now the dominant eschatology is left behind series. But remember that the very first time that appeared was 180 years ago. Yes?
What do you say to people that believe that, like, with all their heart, like, they just are totally into that? What do you say?
I'm very gentle with them.
Uh-huh.
I usually, every time I do a Revelation seminar, and I've done, you know, a couple dozen at this point, every time, my whole first lecture is saying a couple of things. I say, we're going to function off three principles. Number one, the principle of humility. I said, I'm not going to stand up here and act like I have 100% of my theology accurate. There's something that I'm saying to you, even in this class period, that's not right. I don't know what it is. If I did know, I would change it, because I don't want to be wrong. But the fact of the matter is I'm fallible. And that's just the truth. And so I'm not going to stand up here and pretend that I've got it all figured out and you're just an idiot. But what I am going to say is this is where I'm at. And so I always ask them, I say, so disagree with me. It's okay. I won't lose sleep at night. I said, but when we disagree, two things need to happen. Number one, we need to do it with respect. Because you're my brother and sister in Christ, and I'm assuming that you want to come to the truth just as much as I do. And number two? We do it with respect. Oh, you have to tell me why. You can't just say, I disagree. Tell me why. I want to know your thought process of why you disagree with me so that maybe I can change my mind. But just looking at me and saying, well, I just think that's ridiculous. Why? Well, I just do. Well, that doesn't help anybody at all. So that's my first principle. My second one is submission, principle of submission. I say, I want the text to change me. I don't want to change the text because I can make the text say whatever I want. That's the truth. And I want to do the absolute best I can to have the text tell me what it wants to say and not for me to tell the Holy Spirit what I want to say. And then my third principle is the principle of context. And this is where the rubber meets the road. And so I say, listen, if we keep the first two in place, the third one should guide our conversations. And my question is this: what do you want me to do with this passage? And that, at that point, I'm asking the question fervently out of a heart that wants to know. I don't want to push an agenda that's not Jesus's. But I will say this: there are some major dangers with the rapture theology that a lot of people that hold it don't even understand. For example, in the Scofield Reference Bible, I have one in my office you can look at. There should be one up in the library too. Scofield Reference Bible. He was one of the major proponents of the dispensation movement at the turn of the 20th century. So in the 1900s, 1907, 1911, 1915, those are the dates of the prints and reprints of the Scofield Reference Bible. At the bottom of the Sermon on the Mount, so chapters 5 through 7 of Matthew, he says that in its primary application, the Sermon on Mount says nothing about the privilege nor the duty, and that's an exact quote, for the church. It says nothing about the privilege or the duty of the church. Why? He says because that belongs to the kingdom. Now follow me here. This is what he's thinking. They believe that the kingdom isn't in existence yet. That the kingdom comes about once the rapture happens, the 7 years, then the kingdom begins for the 1,000 years on earth. That's part. That is a central part of the rapture theology. The kingdom is in the future. You follow me? He says, well, even though Jesus came in Matthew chapter 4, verse 17, saying, repent for the kingdom of heaven is near, that he didn't establish the kingdom. Why? Because in chapter 12 of the Beelzebub controversy, and you guys know these chapters because we've been studying them all semester. In chapter 12 of the Beelzebub controversy, he said that is the moment whenever the Jews rejected the kingdom, so Jesus shifts to plan B, which happens to be the church. So the church was never supposed to happen, according to dispensational theology. The church is a hiatus, an unfortunate plan B before the kingdom has to come about. Therefore, now listen to the implications of this. Everything that happens before the Beelzebub controversy in chapter 12 is for the kingdom, not the church. And what's before chapter 12 in the Gospel of Matthew? Sermon on the Mount. Therefore, Scofield comes out and says, Sermon on the Mount has nothing to do with the church. Why? Because that's whenever the kingdom was being established. But that switched in chapter 12. You see the implications of this? Like, sometimes it drives me crazy when people talk about things like the rapture and eschatology as if they're no big deal. Oh, you know what? I'm a pan-millennialist. It'll all pan out in the end. That's a cop-out because you're lazy you don't want to deal with all the issues. Or the pro-millennial. I'm all for it. Good. But you have to understand that the Bible teaches eschatology not just for curiosity's sake, but for the hopes and the plea that it will change the way that you are acting right now. Eschatology is always impacting your ethic in the present. Always. Matter of fact, the entire American foreign policy in regards to Israel is based off of eschatology. You want to say it doesn't impact today? Right? They believe that the nation of Israel that was created in 1948 is the key link that we need for the end times, the eschatology of the second coming of Jesus, the rapture, to occur. Therefore, even whenever Israel is destroying people inhumanely, we will defend them. Why? Because our eschatology tells us we have to. Eschatology doesn't affect the way you look right now. As a matter of fact, I will never forget this. Read the Left Behind series. This astounded me. The secretary of the Antichrist, Nikolai Carpathia, his secretary, at one point during one of the plagues, whenever all of darkness is surrounding Babylon, okay? Now, I'm giving you into the story. You may not know it, but listen to the implications of this theology. She received the mark of the beast. Why? She's the secretary of the Antichrist. She's not going to get away from that. She received it. And at one point, she's sitting in darkness, and a guy named Rayford Steele, who's kind of the key person for the good team, he can see because he has not the mark of the beast. And he's in the room with her, and she knows somebody's in there, and she speaks out to him and starts talking to him. And she realizes that he is not on the dark side. And then she asks him this. She says, "Is there any hope for me?" She's like, I'm not kidding. This is his quote right back to her. "No, you've already received the mark. There's nothing I can do for you." I remember stopping going, what? Like, that doesn't sound right. Somebody is inquiring about converting and they tell them, "You can't? Really? Our eschatology doesn't affect the way that we read the rest of the Bible? If Jesus came saying he's going to establish a kingdom, but we say he didn't, that the church isn't the kingdom, or it isn't a part of the kingdom manifested on earth, that the church is an unfortunate plan B, that everything's going to be destroyed by and by, so maybe we can just destroy the earth as much as we want? Do you see how this affects everything that we do? This is not just an issue to dialogue about in the ivory towers of scholasticism. This isn't just some sterile, pristine discussion that we can have in the classroom and you go out and it doesn't affect any way that you live. This molds and affects the way that people live, the way that they move, the way they view the church, the way they view God, the way they view the kingdom. I think at that point, I would say it's an important issue to deal with. As a matter of fact, anything that says that the temple needs to be rebuilt and that sacrifices need to be reinstituted for the atonement of our sins because that what Jesus did at the cross will be suspended for the 7 years of tribulation, I have a major problem with that. I have a major problem with that. Because now you're not just talking about things that affect you. You're saying you're changing what Jesus even did. The reason why I am okay with dedicating my life to these issues is because I think these are the issues, some of the major issues that are destroying our churches in America. Because it's a very selfish theology. But all that to say this, how do I deal with this issue? Very gently. Because there are three things that will get you an earful or an eyeful in your life. Somebody will either start screaming at you or they'll punch you in the face. Three things. Money. If you mess with somebody's money, you're going to get an earful or an eyeful. If you mess with somebody's medicine, earful and eyeful. Just ask the people at Walgreens. Good grief. People come unglued whenever their meds aren't there on time. Or if you mess with somebody's millennial view, try it. I've never seen so much venom spit out at me through hate mail, which nobody will sign their name, which is obviously constructive for all of us, than whenever I start talking about people's revelation view, especially the rapture. People will call you false teachers, they'll call you a heretic, they will say you're of the devil because you're challenging something that came onto the scene for the very first time in 1830. It's the way it is. So it's a very sensitive issue and you need to be very sensitive with it. Yeah?
Do you go and confront people that have that view or do you let them ask you?
I don't know about the word confront. If anybody brings it up, I make them realize that I'm uncomfortable with where they're headed with that. But I don't immediately just say, "Oh, the rapture doesn't exist." Like, I don't do that. Like, if somebody says something like, "Well, we'll be raptured one day," I'd be like, "Eh, I'm not so sure about that." You know, or something along those lines. Do I go after people in the rapture? No. No, they'll come to you. They'll come to you. But do I shy away from the topic? Not at all. But you cannot be a jerk with issues like this. You cannot be pompous and like, "Well, I've got it all figured out." You can't. Because a lot of people's... I was talking to a lady. I was doing a lecture at this 8 weeks at Christ Church of Orinoco. This was a year and a half ago. And very first session, lady raises her hand. "What do you think about the Left Behind series? Because every summer I read all 13 books." I was tempted to say, "Do you read your Bible that often?" But I was like, "Nah, don't do that." And so I just gently said, I said, "Do you want the short answer or the long answer?" She said the short answer, and I said, "I'm going to say this very respectfully. I think it's bogus." And she kind of looked at me and I just said, don't freak out. I said, I know you're thinking, oh, he's a heretic. And I just said, but listen, hey, I could be wrong. I understand that. And I understand a lot of people are attached to these. But number one, we got to remember, this is fiction. It is in the fiction section. I'm not going to the systematic theology section when I'm looking for Left Behind series. But number two, I said, I understand how much it means to you. But my question is, even if it means so much to you, where do we find it in the Bible? And I said, and thankfully, we're going to be studying this over the next 7 weeks. They come to you. By the end of the 7 weeks, by the end of the 8 weeks total, she was like out proselytizing people against the rapture. Like she was bringing them like, the rapture's not true, like bringing them in. Like, and they were very upset with her. And I had to even kind of talk to her about the dangers of talking about this because people got really upset with her at her work. Because people's hearts are attached to this and they don't even know why. It's almost like when you talk about the rapture, it's almost like you just said, Jesus didn't bodily resurrect. I mean, people freak out. And obviously, I think Jesus bodily resurrected, okay? So don't spread rumors. But seriously, people flip out and I just ask them, why are you freaking out? What have you lost right now? Like, like if the rapture isn't true, what have you really lost? All I'm saying is Jesus can come back at any moment. That's all I'm saying. All I'm saying is that there's nothing that needs to happen before he appears on the scene and makes everything right. That invigorates me. That gets me excited. It doesn't make me like, hold on. Jesus can't come back before the rapture and 7 years of tribulation and 1,000 years of millennial kingdom. I'm going, what are you fighting for? The truth. Well, then show me where it is and we can talk about it. Because we're basing an entire theological system off of really four passages. One of them I don't even count because it's bogus. Revelation 4:1, whenever John it says, come up here from an angel, they try to convince me that when the angel looks at John and says, come up here in Revelation 4:1, that's the rapture of the church. And I'm like, really? Really? I don't think so. Did I tell you guys the Charles Fuller quote last class period? Charles Fuller, who's a proponent of dispensational theology, etc., he was interviewed by a radio station in California, and his quote verbatim, I have the documentation on my computer. His quote was, "There is absolutely no biblical evidence for the teaching of the rapture," and then he says, "And yet, I still believe it." And I simply sit and go, I have a problem with that. I have a problem with that. Because if I can make up whatever I want and that forms my theology and who I am, then I've got a lot of other things like I'd throw out. You know, kind of like the whole sell everything you have and give it to the poor. Let's get rid of that. Let's change that and just say, actually, when he meant the word sell, he meant accumulate everything you have. Whenever he says give it to the poor, he actually meant keep it for yourself. Wow, that was easy. What else can we do? You know? If you want to ignore context, you can make the Bible say whatever you want. Yeah?
Can you restate those three passages that people
use? Yes, the primary rapture theology passages. Matthew chapter 24, verses 36 through 41. 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verse 13 through... Really? Well, they stop. 1 Thessalonians 4, verse 13... And they usually stop before 5:1, but they should read it because it says about times and dates. No one should speculate because we know Jesus is going to come back like a thief in the night, but whatever. It doesn't. So to the end of chapter 4. And then Revelation 4:1 is their other one, although really a lot of their doctrine is based off of Revelation chapter 20, verses 1 through 6. They don't like to deal with 7 through 10 because it's the release of Satan, and they don't have a clue of what to do with the release of Satan. Frankly, amillennialists don't either, but that's a whole other issue. But they, matter of fact, what they end up doing in the 1,000 years, if you read the 13th book of the Left Behind series, in the 1,000 years where it's actually raining, there's still brothels, murders, pornography. In the 1,000 years, when Satan is bound. To which my response is, if that's what the 1,000 years can look like, then why can't that be now? But here's the reason why they have to have that. Is because at the end of the 1,000 years, Satan gathers the nations and he launches an attack on the church, doesn't he? Where do those people come from if there's 1,000 years of peace and tranquility? They don't know what to do with that. So they have to kind of like force evil within the 1,000 years, even though the lion's supposed to be laying next to the lamb. Or, what I like to call that is, maybe the 1,000 years is what we're living now, and the lion and the lamb is heaven. Hey! Isaiah 65 parallels Revelation 21 and 22 more than chapter 20. But who cares about the Old Testament? We can make it say what we want. Okay, we have 13 minutes. And one more, any more questions? Yeah, go ahead.
What's the 7 years then? Is that talking about Jerusalem?
The 7 years, this is even more interesting. And I'll have to give a short answer on this. It'll be inadequate, but it is what it is. In the book of Revelation, there is never once, not even one single time, a mention of 7 years of tribulation. Never once. Not even once. And if I reiterate that a fourth time, never once.
Where do they get that?
They get it from Daniel, chapter 9, the 77s. 70 weeks of 7. 490, they suggest that the last week hasn't been fulfilled yet. And they said that after 483 years, it stopped. The last week will occur in the future. And that's when it happens. Oh, trust me, it gets weirder than that. That's the short answer. But and again, I told you it was going to be inadequate, but that's where they get that. So they're piecemealing Daniel chapter 9, and they're throwing it up here into the future, which is what they do a lot. Was what they do a lot. Anything else? Okay, if you have more questions, by all means, let me know. But let's keep moving so that we have 12 minutes. Because I said we were going to leave 10 minutes early. So, all right. Verse 42. Therefore. Why is that word important? Huh? Come on, principals, students. What?
Because of everything said before.
Yes! This is a resultant phrase. Therefore, in light of verses 36 through 41, in light of the fact that Jesus is going to come back and catch a whole bunch of people unaware, that he's going to come back, just like in the days of Noah, and sweep away the evil. Therefore, keep watch. Therefore, keep watch, because you do not know on what day your Lord will come. But understand this, if the owner of a house had known at what time of night the thief was coming, he would not have kept watch and would not have let his house be broken into. So you also must be ready, because the Son of Man will come in an hour when you do not expect him. What is he comparing the second coming to? A thief in the night. This is where 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 verse 1 gets it. This is where Revelation chapter 16 verse 15 gets the concept of Jesus' second coming being like a thief in the night. Now let's figure out, what does that metaphor mean? Well, if you knew a thief was coming to your house or your dorm room in the next 20 minutes, what would you do? Yeah, you'd call the police, at least be at the place. You wouldn't just necessarily leave. I mean, you'd do what you could to try to defend what you had, right? But here's the problem. Do the thieves ever give us fair warning of when they're going to come? No. So what's the implication? You need to always be ready. Always lock your door. You always do whatever you can in order to protect the people that are inside or whatever. Why? Because thieves can come at any time. And Jesus says, it's kind of like my second coming. That I can come at any time. Therefore what? Be ready. Keep watch. How do we keep watch? By what we do. By what we do. Keep watch is ethical language. It's ethical language. He's saying, how do you prepare yourself? How is the bridegroom ready? Revelation chapter 19 verse 8 says the bridegroom is in fine linen clothes, because fine linen stands for the righteous acts of the saints. How do you keep ready? How do you keep watch? By doing what is right. By keeping justice, mercy, and faithfulness. Where does that come from? Justice, mercy, and faithfulness. What? Matthew 23. When he's talking about the tithing. He says, you guys tithe the mint, the dill, and the cumin, but you are ignoring the more important matters of the law, which are justice, mercy, and faithfulness. And that's going to be played out throughout these next couple of chapters, or next several verses. Okay. So notice, though, the difference of the language. What is he emphasizing here? Keep watch. Why? Because it's going to happen and you won't even know when it's going to happen. How is that different from the first 35 verses?
First 35 verses have signs.
Yeah, he says keep watch, but what he says also is keep watch for whenever there are rumors and rumors of war and wars. Keep watch and look out for whenever you see false messiahs pretending to be me. Keep watch and look for the abomination of desolation that's a signal to get out of Dodge. Keep watch. It's like a fig tree. That whenever it starts to bud, you know summer is near. He's saying the signs are going to be clear. But the second coming comes along and what is he saying? You're not going to know. It's like a thief. It can happen at any minute. It can happen at any moment. Moving on, he says in verse 45, what he's going to do now here is this. He is going to string together four parables. Four parables that all emphasize the same thing. The unexpected return of Jesus and the exhortation for his people to be ready. Who then is the faithful and wise servant whom the master has put in charge of the servants in his household to give them their food at the proper time? It will be good for that servant whose master finds him doing so when he returns. You see what he's saying? If I've put you in charge of feeding my people, it would be a good thing that you'd be doing what I told you to do whenever I came back. That's what he's saying. He's using a parable. When a master leaves and he returns. Verse 47. I tell you the truth. He will put him in charge of all of his possessions. But suppose that servant is wicked and says to himself, my master is staying away a long time. And then begins to beat his fellow servants and is to eat and drink with drunkards. Now here's an irony of this. In Matthew chapter 11, what is Jesus accused of in verses, I think, 16 and 17? Yeah. He goes around eating and drinking with drunkards. And here what's ironic is the wicked servant's doing that. And Jesus is going, by your standards, that's wrong. So let's just play that game. If the guy comes back, he's like, hey, the master's not coming back for a long time. Notice the emphasis there. He's not coming back for a long time. What's that emphasizing? A significant delay. He's going to be showing his cards here about the second coming very clearly. He expects there to be a significant delay. He says, the guy's like, hey, I'll start beating all the fellow servants because I'm the master. Who does that sound like in Jesus' context? Think of Matthew 23, which prompts this whole discussion. Those who sit in Moses' seat. The Jewish elite. Because man, God hasn't come back in a long time. Maybe we'll just start beating the fellow servants or burdening them with things that we won't even lift a finger to lift. But forcing them to do it, otherwise they're not even going to be allowed in the gates that we are the gatekeepers of. His fellow servants that eat and drink with drunkards, the master of that servant will come on a day when he does not expect him and at an hour he is not aware of. Notice, day and hour. Day and hour. It's an idiom for you have no idea what time. He will cut him to pieces and assign him to a place with the hypocrites where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Why is that hypocrites word important? Chapter 23. He's been calling the Jewish elite over and over hypocrites, right? You hypocrites! You brood of vipers! You blind guides! But hypocrites is what he hammers on all the time. And where does this evil servant go to be? With the hypocrites, in a hellish-like place, where there's weeping and gnashing of teeth. So what is the implication of this first parable? Be ready, because at any time the king can come. Be ready. Second parable, chapter 25, verse 1. At that time, at what time? At the second coming. At that time, the kingdom of heaven will look like 10 virgins who took their lamps and went out to meet the bridegroom. 10 is an important number, eh? What does it stand for? Completeness. 10 virgins, complete amount of people right here. 10 virgins are there. 5 of them, verse 2, were foolish and 5 were wise. This is paralleling the previous parable. We had a wise servant and we had a foolish servant. Same dichotomy. The foolish ones took their lamps, but did not take any oil with them. The wise, however, took oil in jars along with their lamps. The bridegroom was a long time in coming. You hear that? Major difference from the first 35 verses where it says, oh, he's coming, you know, this is going to happen in your generation. And in here he's saying, no, he's a long time coming. It's a delay, significant delay. A long time coming, and they all became drowsy and fell asleep. At midnight, the cry rang out, "Here's the bridegroom, come out to meet him." Then all the virgins woke up and trimmed their lamps. The foolish ones said to the wise, "Give us some of your oil, our lamps are going out." "No," they replied, because they were selfish. "There may not be enough for both of us and you. Instead, go to those who sell oil and buy some for yourselves." Why did they not give them oil? Because let's look how big the oil would be. This is their lamp they would have had. This is actually Mark Moore's lamp. And one of the marks up there is indicative of the fact that it was Herodian. It would have been probably in one of the temples of Herod, possibly one that Jesus even walked past. But that's how big that the lamp is itself. It would not illuminate an entire room. It would not illuminate like an entire building. It would obviously illuminate just a small part of the room. So you're not even getting much bang for your buck with this. But notice the size of the oil. See, I have the $10 bill there so you can see how big it is. It's not big. That little thing of oil is not going to be holding very much. So whenever the wise virgins say, "We wouldn't have enough to give you and me," they're not being stingy, they're being practical. That's how big it is. There's not much to go around. So if they all spread out the oil, they may not even be able to go to find the bridegroom at all. Because they probably run out. You see the issue? They're not being jerks, they're being practical. Verse 10. But while they were on their way to buy the oil, the bridegroom arrived. The virgins who were ready went in with him to the wedding banquet, and the door was shut. Later, the others also came. "Sir, sir," they said, "open the door for us." But he replied, "I tell you the truth, I don't even know you. Therefore, keep watch, because you do not know the day or the hour." What is the implication of this parable?
Keep watch.
Keep watch. Why? Because what? Because Jesus can come in any moment. The issue is not the fact that the bridegroom or that the bridesmaids weren't able to have their oil and he was just mad at them. The issue was they weren't ready. They weren't ready for his unexpected arrival. They were waiting with eager anticipation, but they were not ready. And Jesus' point is, I can come at any moment, be ready. Martin Luther was asked once. He was asked, if you knew Jesus was coming back tomorrow, what would you do? And Martin Luther's response was, I'd plant my garden today. And the point is this, I'd be ready. If I knew he was coming back tomorrow, I'd make sure I was ready today. And that's the way that Jesus is saying you live every day, as if he is coming back at any moment. Keep watch, be ready, be prepared, do what is right, keep the justice, mercy, and faithfulness a key part of your life. Parable number 3. Ooh, ah. I should stop now. I'm going to go a couple minutes. No, I'm not. I can't. Yeah. Okay. Test on Friday. We're going to pick up with the parable of the talents because that one is abused. I want to spend a little bit of time on it. And then we're going to finish up with the sheep and the goats tomorrow. We are actually on track. I combined some lectures that are at the end. We are on track. We will make it. So, love you guys. See ya in the morn.